verbal testimony, adama. Omidyana tivaram dasya jnanam jana shilakaya jatsu nirtamyena ismai tri girave namaha. Sri Chaitanya Manovishtam Sati Panyena Bhutale Shayam Rupa Sadamayam Sadati Cha Sadantikam Nana Shastra Vicharanai Kamitano Sadhyama Samstapato Lokanam Hittakarano Chibhuvane Manyasharam Yaparo Pancha Kapa Sarivyacha Vipasindu Vaiduja Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Vyadvaita Gadara Srivasade Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, greetings from Rishikesh. Rishikesh is next to Haridwar. Dwara means the gate of the Hari. It's where the Ganga comes from. It's the foothills of the Himalayas. And it's where the Ganga comes from, the Himalayas, and we're right along the bank of the Ganga, and across the river from us is the full town of Rishikesh. We can see the ghats and the little ashrams and the mountains. For those of you who are Beatles fans, right to my right, in the mountains, there's four or five little domes, which is the place of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, where the Beatles stayed. And it's an ideal place, actually, for these kind of retreats. There's 20 people that Gopi Manjari teaches yoga to that is, you know, come on the retreat, mostly from Washington, D.C. And rooms are, you know, really beautiful. Each room has a little porch overlooking the Ganga. And for the people, it's a nice combination of activities. They do about 3 hours of yoga in the morning with guided meditation. I don't really know what goes on there. I don't attend that. And then after breakfast, they go out someplace. Yesterday, a Kinchana came back. So I guess it's called white water rafting. Yeah, it takes 3 hours, and then it comes. The boats come right to your door. But he was saying, "Well, it's great, but real good. It was really great because it was the Ganga, and you see places that you've never seen before." And he said, "Sometimes you stop, and it's just pools of water and white beaches, and you go in and you bathe in the holy Ganga." So, like that, and then in the evening, before the evening dinner, then I give some kind of class. Topic I've really been speaking on, because it's a little bit related to this, I was talking about enmity and how enmity is an emotion generally born from passion and ignorance, so it distorts the purest nature. It distorts the purest nature of the mind. It distorts the pure nature of the mind. And because it distorts the pure nature of the mind, the soul, which is viewing itself through the mind when one is in this material body, therefore gets a distorted image of itself. And when you get a distorted image of yourself, then that's when all the problems happen, because the pure self, this pure awareness, and go to the God for pure self as a servant of Krishna. So as soon as the mind is distorted by lower modes, you're seeing something other than pure awareness, you're experiencing something other than pure awareness, and you're seeing yourself as something as different from the humble and pure servant of God. So I actually have been speaking on that in terms of criticism. There's three manifestations of that feeling of vaisya, which actually means separate or hate, enmity, and one is envy, another is criticism, and another one is resentment. So each day I was speaking on different subjects like that. And it involved really nice discussion, especially when we spoke about resentment and the need for forgiveness, which is a seminar I'm going to develop. So it was really nice because there are a lot of professional people there, and I got their input from the professional viewpoint of the difficulties of these types of feelings and how they've given up. And I put it within the context of yoga. So it's been nice. Now, in terms of this Yoga Sutra, if you remember, the first verse was just saying the importance, the significance of it. Now, as we're studying this particular school of thought called yoga, there's many darshans or philosophies, but this is a particular one, yoga. And then the first four verses, five verses actually, five verses, I'm not sure. It discussed what is yoga. It's this control of the mind, and when one controls the mind by meditation or concentration, the mind gradually comes to its pure state. When the mind is in its pure state, again, the pure soul, the pure awareness, the pure consciousness, which views itself when it's encaged, and the purusha, the soul, is encaged within this body. The pure soul views itself from the mind, by the mind. When it's in its pure state, the mind is reflective, and you can see yourself as you are. And when you can see yourself as you are, and have that platform of discrimination based on pure knowledge, then eventually you can transcend the mind and attain the perfection of samadhi. In the yoga school, it's called asampragata samadhi. And then, as it described that, and at that time, then the soul abides in its pure nature when the mind is controlled, and one even transcends the mind, the soul at that time abides in its nature. And as I mentioned, there's different theories of what happens at that time, including one theory, which is at least one school of Buddhism. I can't speak for all schools of Buddhism, but at least the prominent school of Buddhism, when the vehicle by which you perceive yourself is gone, then the consciousness of the soul itself is gone. But here in the philosophy of yoga, and in this aspect, it's very, very close to Vedanta, which is the school which my understanding and my tradition is coming from, that the example is getting very simple, like a crystal that reflects a red flower. If the red flower is gone, the pure nature of the crystal is still there. So therefore, when the material thoughts are gone, and even in the yoga system, the mind is dissolved, the material mind is dissolved, the pure consciousness remains, and it remains abiding in its own pure nature, which is a state of perfection. And otherwise, if the soul is not in its own nature, and this is a problem, then the soul or the chi identifies with the mind.
And because it is enterprise with the mind, then it suffers the fluctuations of the mind, which are distinct from the pure soul. As a person who is dreaming, although he's in good health, he's in a good situation, he suffers according to the nature of the dream, which is actually external to himself. Another example would be caught in the water. The moon is reflected in the water. And if one misidentifies the moon with the reflection in the water, then when the water moves, then one gets the experience or gets the feeling that the moon is moving. So similarly, when you misidentify with the mind, which is material, which is when the pure soul is somehow in time immemorial, identifying with the material mind, then when the mind moves, then the soul experiences that type of movement. And as we know, there are six movements on the material sphere. There's birth, there's growth, there's maintenance, there's reproduction, there's old age, and there's death. And these changes cause different types of fears, especially the fear of non-existence. So non-existence is an illusion, but it exists when one identifies with the material mind. And therefore, and that's one of the greatest fears, the fear of non-existence, the fear of death. And from the time you're born, as long as you identify with the material mind and its outer covering the material body, as long as you have this identification, you're in this world of duality. Because whatever you do, and whatever you do, or whatever you enjoy in that conception, there's the duality that it's temporary and will be gone. So the more you invest in it, the more subtly you're actually fearful, because you're losing what you're attached to. So this is classic Samkhya philosophy. And as the first five verses here, because the main verse that's being analyzed now is the key definition of yoga, which is yoga chitta vritti nirodha. That yoga means to quell the fluctuations of the mind. So now, after the first five verses, yoga has been described very, very clearly. Then in the next 7 to 12, vritti will be described, and then from 13 to 16, rodha, the quelling of the mind. So vritti, the fluctuations of the mind, and it was described basically, it's kind of like waves in the sea. The waves are constantly churning, changing the form and shape of the sea. So as the vrittis come, the thoughts, the emotions, the fear, come from the mind, the mind transforms, and as the mind transforms, due to identifying with the mind, you experience that vikara or transformation. And so that the waves, the vrittis, the waves of thoughts and emotions, and that's basically what the material mind is basically composed of. It has experiences, latent experiences, latent memories called samskaras, and then they rise in waves. Again, the example is given like a computer, unlimited information in the hard disk, but what you experience of the hard disk is what's on the screen. So that's the vrittis, that's the thoughts, that's what we're experiencing right now. And in the verse describing vrittis, he described that there's five states of the mind, and eternally the mind must be in one of these five states. Today we're going to discuss the first state, which is called pramana. Pramana means right knowledge. It also means the means of attaining knowledge. But in this case, it means really It's going to describe how you get right knowledge and how the mind comes in the condition of understanding what's there properly. That's one state of the mind, that you understand what's there properly because you've used a proper pramana or means of knowing. And those means of knowing are going to be defined as three. Direct a direction, direct perception, logic, or testimony from authority, which is called agama. Of the five types, the five states that the mind can be in at any. So that first one is pramana. We'll discuss that today. Correct knowledge. And then there's error. You have a misconception, just like there's a rope and you see a snake. So that's a condition of the mind to be an illusion. Then there's the culpa. The culpa means imagination. And that's going to be discussed. Imagination, it's not that you're viewing something correctly, but the mind is creating some image, which may have some correct information in it, but it's not that you're experiencing it directly. We'll get into those more. The fourth one is memory, smriti, and the fifth one is sleep. So what Patanjali is saying is the mind is in one of these five, at any time, the mind is in one of these five conditions. And then he mentions, and then we'll get up to today, is within these five types of vrittis, some are unfavorable klishta, and some are unfavorable aklishta. It doesn't mean the five states of the mind are favorable or unfavorable. It means within them they can either be favorable or unfavorable. And that we can discuss. And klishta means basically torment or just unfavorable condition. And that's when the passion and ignorance comes from life. Because those types of thoughts bring you away from the state of pure awareness. Because they distort the pure state of the mind, which is reflective of the pure soul. So those types of thoughts that are coming, emotions, there, and some are favorable. And what are favorable thoughts? Yoga. Why? Discrimination, knowledge. Why? Moral feelings, moral sentiments, moral understanding. Why? Because those thoughts are the ones that bring one closer to sattva or the pure state of mind. And they're the thoughts that subdue passion and ignorance, which distort the pure condition of the mind. So it's a very nice, comprehensive analysis of the mind. Now we'll discuss X7. So he wants to define, this is the first state of the mind, he wants to define pramana. And pramana means the method of knowing. And of course, in this condition, he's describing it as the method of knowing, how you actually know something is true. But it's also, sometimes it's described, the effect of ascertaining something properly is you're in a state of mind where you see things as they are. So how to ascertain the right knowledge? Let's see, in English, in Western philosophy, it's called epistemology, and that means the study of what sources constitute valid knowledge of something, or what are the instruments of attaining accurate knowledge. It is a study. What are the instruments of attaining accurate knowledge? Literally means a pramana, means to know something. So how do you come to the correct knowledge? So he says in the yoga system, sometimes there's given more than three pramadas. But those who say that there are only three pramadas, or means of knowing, which is direct perception, inference, and verbal testimony or hearing from a trustworthy source, they would say that all other methods are based on these. So the first method, this is by Pantanjali, is pratyaksha, or direct perception, or sense perception. We can know something is true or valid if we experience it through one or more of our senses. If we see it, if we smell it, if we touch it, if we hear it or taste it, I guess the English word will be called empiricism. And Vyas explains this in the yoga school. Now, it's different from the school of Vedanta, which considers the highest pramana is hearing from a trustworthy source. In the school of yoga, this is considered the main pramana, because the main pramana of yoga, the process of yoga, is to quell the mind and have experience of your true awareness. So Vyasa explains that what this sense perception means, it's a state or condition of the mind. A condition of the mind, it's a vritti, which where you apprehend both the, and it's a little technical, but I think it'll be really clear, both the specific, the shesh, and generic, samanya, nature of an object through the channel of the five senses. It means, an example would be like a dog. So first you give a general categorization. It comes through the mind, and there's some understanding or mechanism of experience in that you say, oh, this is a dog. So you have direct experience. That you see the animal, and now you're having the a valid experience of what that object is, perhaps through your eyes, for example, in this case. And then there's a specific thing. Oh, of the dogs, this is a a poodle. So you get a more specific understanding. And therefore, you're experiencing as it is. There's a dog, which is a poodle before you, and you're experiencing, yes, this is what it is. And it's like that with any of the objects. And, you know, according to the yoga theory, how it is the mind is very malleable. The mind of the chitta is very malleable. And some schools say in the Buddha, some say in the chitta is a separate thing. But when you see something, it makes an impression in the mind, if you can see like there's clay, and you take something and you make an imprint in the clay, then from the imprint you can view the object. These days say how pure consciousness views something with an imprint of that object that somehow or other through your experience or your training, you have the ability to identify it. And you have that impression, and first you identify the impression. Oh, yes, the impression which I just got is similar to the impressions I already have in the consciousness, which identify this is a particular animal, dog. And then you have other impressions in the consciousness, which in your subconscious, through your training, through your knowledge, through your experience, which enable you to differentiate which type of dog it is. So that impression is there in the chitta or the mind, just like an impression. And then pure consciousness, which use things through the mind, a seizure. Just like if you put an impression on a film and you shine light to it, then when the light goes through the object becomes known. So to our consciousness, as our consciousness comes through the mind, then we begin to view these things. Yoga school emphasizes that. And the next pramana is anuman, or inference, or logic. And the classic example would be is you don't see the object, but you see something else which shares qualities with that object. And therefore, you can identify that object. And the classic example is given, you don't see the object directly, but you see smoke. But in your experience, you have identified smoke with fire. You have that understanding there already in the consciousness that wherever there is fire, there is smoke. So although you're not directly seeing the object, you're only seeing the smoke, but not the fire. But you are ascertaining that there is fire there, although you're not directly seeing it, by an assumption that what you're seeing also shares that quality. And it differs, inference differs from the first source of knowledge, which is sense perception, because sense perception requires that one actually sees a fire. In anuman or logic, the fire itself is not actually seen, but its presence is inferred by something else that is perceived. That is, we see the smoke and we infer the presence of the fire. We're going to leave a lot of time for questions today because I'm almost finished in one sense. And this is much different than the the kind of, when I speak on Bhakti Shastra or even Bhagavad Gita, it's a little bit different. Because I'm just relaying, anyway. Now, the third source is verbal testimony. I guess we call this deductive reasoning, deductive knowledge, and what we call anuman inductive knowledge. I can feel Mahamuni's mind because I made that wrong. We'll talk about that soon. Verbal testimony. So you're relying on accurate information through the medium of words by a trustworthy person. One has perceived or inferred the existence of the object. Someone is not. So someone else, either by direct perception or inference, who's a trustworthy source, has seen or inferred that something exists, and you trust that person. So you have, it's not perception because you've not seen it, and it's not inferred because you've not made that logical reference. But you accept it because it comes from a trustworthy source. Now, I can speak about this because in the school of Vedanta, and I come from the school of Vaishnava, Gaudiya Vedanta, we accept this as the topmost pramana. And we're going to discuss that. Why? It's like you go to a doctor. Now, you have trust in that doctor because he is authorized and he's reputable. And then he checks you out and he looks in a microscope and he sees something, right? You know, he step close to your heart and sees something and says, you have a heart condition. And you accept, oh yes, this is the truth. I see a heart. You have not directly seen it. He has seen it. But because you trust his authority, you accept that knowledge. Or he looks at your various symptoms, and by those symptoms, by inference, he can understand that these symptoms have an absolute and invariable relationship called vyapti with this disease. When someone has these symptoms, he has this disease. And that's also a condition of a vyapti or inference, that it's an absolute relationship. Where there is fire, there is always, where there is smoke, there is always fire first. So it has to be an absolute relationship. So he sees an absolute relationship between these symptoms, that you have no appetite, that your urine is very, very dark, and your liver is hard. And then he says, you have hepatitis. So he's made an inference. So either based on what an authority is seen or what authority is inferred, then you accept something as valid knowledge. So what he's discussing by these three types of terms, what are the means for coming to the state where you actually can perceive something directly, or you can perceive something truly, which is one of the qualities, one of the five states of the mind. Now, Vyasa, in his commentary, describes a trustworthy person as someone whose statements cannot be contradicted. And how this works? The words of a reliable authority enter the ear and produce an image, a vritti, in the mind of the hearer that corresponds to the object experienced by the trustworthy person. The trustworthy person has experienced that truth, and due to your trust in him, you can put the same impression in your consciousness even though you haven't directly experienced it. And within Vedanta, the trustworthy source is considered the Shastra. The best verbal testimony is considered Shastra, and it's considered Shruti. The best self is directly hearing from the Vedas. And the concept of the Vedas is when the Supreme Lord breathes out and this universe is created, with the same vibration that creates the universe, and even in the Bible it says, God said, let there be light. With the same vibration that creates the universe, that same vibration is a body of knowledge that describes, that gives you knowledge of the universe. And what's knowledge? Knowledge means to describe the purpose and utility of something. So the Vedas contain a vast information about what is actually true. And if you come in contact with that, according to the school of Vedanta, you have that's the best means of actually knowing something. And it's considered an infallible, trustworthy source. Of course, in other schools of Vedanta, they also consider Smriti. And Smriti means when trustworthy people hear the truth, they may write other things based on the truth, which hold the same authority as the Vedas. that's Shruti and that's Smriti. That's remembered from the Vedas by pure souls. So, which is the highest pramana, the best method of knowing? Yoga says objection, direct experience. Vedanta says agama, verbal testimony. With my teacher in his commentary, what Sri Prabhupada said in the introduction of Isha Upanishads, he describes some of the defects of pratyaksha or direct experience as imperfect senses. They're limited in what you can see. A sound exists, but you can't perceive that sound because your senses are imperfect. The dog can hear a certain sound. When you blow a dog whistle, there's a sound in the ear, but you don't have the proper senses to hear it. So there's the senses are imperfect. They tend to be illusion. You may see the sun as a small sphere in the sky, but actually it's much bigger than the earth. When we look in the sky, it's not looking bigger than the earth. So there's a tendency to be illusion. We tend to commit mistakes. Anyway, there's four, I forgot them right now. Of course, I guess the comeback from yoga would be is you're just giving examples of something where it's not pratyaksha because one is not directly perceiving it. And what they're saying is when one directly perceives something truly, that's the best source of knowledge. And what it comes from Vedanta is saying that that method itself is so faulty. To hear from trustworthy sources is a much better way of getting valid knowledge. And I guess then they would counter too, but that's based on direct perception. So it's based on direct perception of the people who realize it. Of course, they would say the direct perception is God because the data is the perception of God of the world or those that represent it, but then they'd say, okay, but still, you have to hear from them, and that's direct perception. Okay, so I think we covered it as clear as I can. So the first state of the mind is that. I'm going to put it now into question and answer mode, and I'll ask Mahamuni if he has any comments, because he actually has to study this. One second. Give me 30 seconds, and then I'll tell you when. Unmute your phone now, it won't work. But after I do this, I'm learning this science now of how to use this phone, I think. Well, what's going on? It's not working. Let me see if I'm still on. Oh my God. Mamuni, can you unmute your phone? Same problem. Can anybody unmute their phone? Anybody like to say Hare Krishna? Hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it's Reti Krishna.
Okay, so it is on the Q&A mode. Okay. Thanks. Is it?
No problem.
Okay, people have unmuted their phones, so it is. Mahamuni, are you there?
Maharaj?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Can you hear me, Maharaj?
I can now. Yeah.
Maharaj, it's Mooney. May I ask you a question? Are you hearing an echo, Maharaj, or is it just me?
I think people unmute their phones. I told people to try, and they do, and then they don't unmute. They don't mute them again.
Can you hear me, or is it too?
I can hear you perfectly. The echo's not on my side.
Okay, for what it's worth, I don't know what it is, but on our phone, we still can't unmute. I don't know if it's a problem we have, but I'm at Ross's, so I'm calling now with my cell phone again.
Well, there's something about that phone that doesn't unmute, so just understand.
We unmuted, but what happens is, after we hit *6, it says, the conference thing says, the organizer has muted the conference.
Yeah, that happens to me too, Mahamun.
Yeah.
Well, then how do you get on now?
I'm on my cell phone. I just called. I'm at Ross's, but I'm calling in my cell phone right now.
So the cell phone works and the regular phone doesn't? Is that it?
No, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's because we called in originally and then the...
Well, what happened today is I pressed *7, and usually you get a sound of what it does, so it didn't give me the sound of what it does myself. But anyway, we'll keep on trying. But now you're unmuted.
I had a few questions, but one was just a fairly simple one, I think. So we're right now trying to understand the pramanas, because they're one of the five transformations of the mind that yoga helps stop. But are there other ways? Are there other applications of the pramanas for those of us who are practicing yoga or bhakti or other kind of sadhanas? How do you see them helping us in our practice? Aside from this idea that maybe for some yogis way down the line, they may renounce all the vrittis, including pramanas. I don't think we do that, but as bhaktas, but how do you see them in? How do you see the pramanas in our practice now? What do they have?
From the standpoint of this is many of us have been studying Gaudiya Vedanta for many, many years. Mahamuni?
Yeah.
You can hear me? I'm going to try to mute all the phones again and then unmute it, okay?
Okay.
Can I try that?
Sure.
This is an echo, so I'm going to try to do that.
Okay.
Okay, Mahamuni, can you unmute now?
Yep, now, yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, now it's much better, okay.
So somehow I'm on Ross's phone. We just unmuted. We were just unable to unmute, so thanks for whatever you did, it worked. So you can hear me better now? Everything's okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want me to repeat my question, or...?
Yeah, repeat the question now.
So basically my question is, for those of us who right now are practicing in various ways, what role do you see the pramanas as having in our life of practice? Because obviously I think the role of pramanas is not just as something we're supposed to renounce. I mean, in fact, like I said, I don't think we renounce them at all, even though some yogis might.
You're not of them. Say that again.
I was saying that I think obviously the pramanas have a really important role in our lives, more than just renouncing them, even though some yogis may renounce them. And so I'm wondering how you see them informing our lives as we make decisions or things like, what role do they have in our lives as we're practicing right now, whether it's perception, inference, or testimony?
Well, I guess, basically this whole study is just giving us a science of how the mind works so we can use it better. And, I'm not so sure in this one as practical application is as important than just the general conception that the mind is in different states, that are changing, and that those states have different effects. And it depends what school you're in. I mean, I guess if you come to our school, what's the practical application? And practical application is to encourage you to, I guess it would encourage you that the best way to get valid knowledge is to find a trustworthy source of knowledge. And I guess the practical application would depend on the particular school itself. If you're asking from our tradition, the way it's been traditionally understood is practical. Come in. One second. The way it's traditionally understood as practical is that because of the defect of the sense perception, you know, if you just rely on empiricism, you have to be aware of the defects. And that hearing from a trustworthy source and is a better means of coming to the state of mind where you understand things properly.
So how do we come to it? I worry sometimes because I feel like we denigrate the other pramanas in a way where we don't have to. And let me know if I'm maybe wrong about this. But how do you go about determining who's a trustworthy source if you can't trust your ability to infer and perceive? Right? I mean, at some point, doesn't it have to come down to that we have experience and we reflect on our experience of some person?
They seem
reasonable to us. And you might say, well, I've talked to other people, too, who think they're reasonable. But at some point, I have to determine why I think these people I'm talking to are trustworthy.
Yes.
And it seems to me that there's a fundamental role for perception and inference that they have a really important role. Because testimony alone, well, how do you determine who's a good testifier or not?
Well, I would say it's something like this, is that obviously your frame, it's obvious that perception is a valid means of knowing, right? And inference is a valid means of knowing. Right? So no one's denying that. Right? And it's just a question, you know, and therefore you have a certain pramana. You have a certain experience. And how that experience has been developed may have been obviously by many pramanas. You experience things in the world and it created valid conceptions of understanding. They're all realistic, right? But it creates valid, it creates that state of mind where you understand things properly. And then, of course, inference has also been there, and you understand things properly. And you've had certain trust in certain people to develop things properly. So now you're within that particular frame of reference where you have a certain understanding. Which is probably developed by different pramanas, because they're not saying that they're invalid, they're just limited. And now when you, you know, want to understand things, especially go forward to things that are beyond your perception, that finding that trustworthy source is the best. Now I'll give you an example. Let's talk about medical health, right? Well, obviously, there's direct perception. You have to say, well, the pain is there. And then there's inference. Well, according to my experience, if the pain is there, it must be, you know, caused by overeating. Because I've had so much experience that when your stomach is bad, it's connected with overeating or something like that. So obviously there's something, but how to go further to get the perfect knowledge you need? Well, you go to a medical doctor. And it's not that you don't test him out by your directed experience, it's not that you don't test them out by your inference, but your direct experience and inference can help you to understand who's a trustworthy authority. So we're saying is when you can actually ascertain that, that to get knowledge that is beyond your senses and beyond your inference, this is the best way to do it. And, you know, it may be by inference. It could be some kind of inference like this. I took Vedic knowledge and I tried to understand it. I applied it and I saw it was true. And then I took some more Vedic knowledge, I applied it, I saw it was true. I see that everyone I respect accepts this Vedic knowledge. And it's commonly accepted by authority within this tradition. Okay, I accept this as a trustworthy authority. And if it is a trustworthy authority, right, then that's the best way of having valid information. Because that person has direct perception, that person has inference beyond you. Not only that, by that experience and that inference, etc., he has greater knowledge and faith of a trustworthy source, which is divine Shastra.
Okay, that makes, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. And one final question.
It does,
absolutely.
Okay.
I don't want to, now's not the time for my pet peeves. I do think that we often denigrate perception and inference in ways that I think hurt people's ability to reflect on their own experience that I think would be healthier for people.
I think give me an example and share it because it could be valuable for people.
Well, I mean, I think it's a fairly common thing that I've seen certain bhaktas say things like this. Well, you know, such and such person said this and it seems totally far out and it makes no sense to me, but hey, you know, it's transcendental. Right? Now, on one hand, that makes sense. I mean, I think it's reasonable quite often to say that if we have an authority that we deeply trust, that they're going to say things that may be beyond our frame of reference and we can trust them. But I think sometimes we use that way of approaching things and apply it in all sorts of cases where it shouldn't apply, and it allows a lot of wrong decisions to continue being made. And it allows for... Does that make sense or no? I mean, it's just...
It does make sense, and the way you can analyze it, according to the Pramanas, is that that person, right, doesn't have sufficient trust in the Shastra, because that's not what the Shastra says. What the Shastra says is that the way you understand the absolute truth is by thoughtfulness and faith. And it works something like this. You have faith in the authority, some divine, whatever it is, trust. It may be some, whatever it is, even in the curious here, some music maestro or, because it's a trustworthy person, so it could be that. Now, this person really knows music. It's a mentor, it's a spiritual mentor. Then you go beyond that. Okay, it's the Shastra. So what happens is what's recommended is you trust that source if you have established it as a trustworthy source. So you accept that source, but at the same time you're accepting that source, you have to understand the limits of your ability to filter that knowledge or the limits of yourself, of your ability to understand that knowledge by the filter of your intelligence, which has been conditioned by, different experiences that may not enable you to understand things properly. So what happens then is you're accepting, now, but when a person in authority says something that you don't understand, if you accept it as an authority, it doesn't mean that if it belies your morality, if it belies your common sense, that you just have to immediately accept, well, this is true. What you have to do is make the effort to understand, have I understood what this this testimony means. And that's where the process of doubting comes in. The doubt is not in the Shastra. The doubt is in your capability to understand it. And therefore, you raise your doubts. And without raising your doubts and getting those doubts clear, you may not come to the point of actually understanding what that verbal testimony or trustworthy source has said. And it's encouraged. And the classic example is Lord Brahma, who heard the Vedas three times. Why did he hear the Vedas three times? He accepted it at faith, but according to his previous experience, when he heard Lord Brahma speak the Vedas, the first time he heard the Vedas, because there's so much fruit of activity, he said the Vedas is fruit of activity. It's karma. But then he said, well, how can this be the absolute truth? It doesn't make sense. So he didn't blindly accept what he heard, but he didn't lose faith in the authority. He just thought, I have to understand this more clearly. So he, and therefore Krishna explained the Vedas again. Right? And when he explained it again, then he understood, well, you know, what this karma is for is to purify you and engage you, but really what's there is the Upanishads. So then he said, well, but that's Gyan. And I'm not sure that Gyan, just philosophical analysis, can be the essence of all the Vedas. So he raised his doubts again. And he was thinking, well, this can't be it. It's not that he lost faith in the verbal testimony, but he wasn't sure he understood it clearly yet. And then it says in the third time he understood, you know, the Daishtasabhyam Eva Vedil Vedantabhid Veda Vedeva Chaham. Of all the Vedas, I am to be known. That it was bhakti or devotion. So I think if the promotion of verbal testimony comes to the point of blind following, you can't inquire to get things more clear, it's there. It's true. But I maybe haven't understood it as true. And therefore, even in verbal testimony, and we see through all the Shastra, it's always dialectic. Because it takes time to ascertain. Because of the frame of reference, everyone has a frame of reference to understand something. Right, we see that, right? There's a Republican frame of reference. There's a Democrat frame of reference. You know, there's so many frame of references. There's an American frame of reference. There's an Indian frame of reference. So if you give a truth, and therefore you can see in Prabhupada's mission. Right? One time, Burijan and Gopi Panadana, those Gopi Panadana's, even two of the main scholars in our tradition. So we went to a disappearance festival for Prabhupada. And then all the senior devotees get up there and they explain their glories of Prabhupada. So one person gets up and explains to Prabhupada like the corporate head of an institution.